This episode of the Deck Tees Podcast is brought to you by Gathering Magic and CoolStuffInc.com. Become a part of their customer rewards program when you make any purchase and receive discounts on all future orders. That is CoolStuffInc.com. Welcome to episode 108 of the Deck Tees Podcast. I am your host, Aaron Campbell. My guest today is a fantasy writer who has received rave reviews for his books, Brood of Bones, Gown of Shadow and Flame, and more. You can also find him writing about Commander on our own, GatheringMagic.com. He is A.E. Marling. Hello.
Hello, Aaron. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on. I didn't realize you were such a big deal.
Oh, well, in my own mind, I am certainly. I'm not exactly as well known as some of the other guests you have in terms of the Magic card circle, so I wanted to introduce myself with my favorite Ravnica guilds, which are Golgarian Simic, and my clan of choice is Sultai. As a player, I'm a 70% Spike, 30% Johnny, and 100% willing to make up arbitrary numbers.
You said my favorite things. You said Golgarian Sultai. We are basically soulmates at this point. Yeah, I had no idea you were such a big deal. Like, I do research on all of my guests, and I admit that I was not familiar with you from your work at Gathering Magic. Like, I'm not much of an EDH player, or I'm very much a novice at that, so I admit that I don't always check out your articles. And the topic that we're going to discuss later in the show, which is going to be a huge surprise, I knew I needed some sort of an expert on, and I was going through people on GM that I hadn't had on before, and the minute I typed in your name, you had a large Twitter following, and I was like, what does this guy do? And then I found out that you are a writer, and you're on Amazon.com, and there are reviews for you on Goodreads.com and other sites that we all know, and I had no idea, and I was just like, whoa!
Previously, I have written reviews on fantasy sites, and I hope to do more writing in the future. Another thing I have done is I've written a short story for the Complete Commander book by Benny Smith, which is on StarCityGames.com.
Oh, I wanted to read that. I just didn't know where to begin. Like, it seemed so lofty.
So, at the time I wrote that, I didn't know too much about Commander myself, but after reading it, I became more comfortable and was able to take the plunge. Mm-hmm.
I still feel like, you know, my main quibble with Commander, it isn't necessarily anything to do with the format. Like, I love the idea of it. I love what people do with it. I love seeing the ideas. For me, it's the social contract where I feel like, you know, I look at Commander as a format where I want to live the dream. You know, I want to throw up my arms and go, wee! And I want to do crazy things and things I shouldn't be allowed to do. And I want other people to do that too. And I also love seeing cards from the past where somebody plays a card and I'm like, oh, I remember that card. And just that warm feeling of nostalgia. Where Commander loses me is people who are in it to win and to crush. And they want to win.
There is a dynamic. On the one hand, for instance, in Innistrad Draft, I really like the Balefire Dragon, I believe it was called. It was a 6/6 flying. When it damages the opponent, all their creatures take damage. You get to burn their dreams to cinders. That's really what I want in a game of Commander. However, there are certain people who are trying to win and do really unfair things very fast, and it is a balancing act. Some people, especially people perhaps who only play Commander, get really serious about it. Whereas I come from a competitive background, I love playing a Grand Prix at that level, and when I play Commander, it is very much an exercise of fun. It's a party game. It's like Super Smash Bros. For Magic, and I really enjoy that. So when you see someone who is playing an unfair deck, you really just have to leverage the politics angle and just take them out very quickly. Mm-hmm. And that is something you can usually do. And it is a fun. Politics are part of the game. That's not another thing which can intimidate people who are used to just the one versus one, me versus you, no holds barred. But politics do play an important part of it, and that's just something, another strategy other players need to learn in order to enjoy the format.
Mm-hmm. So I think if I were able to find a group that we, you know, we all were in agreement as to how we wanted to play, I might be more likely to play it. But I feel like there have been too many times where the wires have gotten crossed where either I'm feeling really competitive and nobody else is, and then I'm suddenly the asshole, you know, or, you know, I go into it expecting to have a fun experience and everyone else wants to be the asshole. And I just can never find people that are on the same wavelength as I am. And that makes me kind of not want to do it.
It is a fine balance. However, I will say, if you and other people are playing the same Commander decks, which are going to be newly released by Wizards of the Coast, I suspect that they will be more balanced and you will have a more even playing field. But again, it is just a matter of finding the right group.
Oh, yeah. One of the most memorable games I think I ever had was I was at Gen Con 2 years ago, and my friend Angie was there with one of her business partners because they were working on a game together, and it was super late. You know, Gen Con was winding down. I mean, it is a 24-hour con, as you might know, so things are still happening, but in terms of the Magic area, you know, most of the area had been cleaned out. It was getting pretty late, and we had just a really good time. I had my Omnath deck. She had a Mimeoplasm deck, Mimeoplasm, I think it is, and sure. Her other friend was playing, I think it's called Zedru.
Yes, that one can be surprisingly aggravating,
and
go on.
And we just had a really good time, and we were having such a good time that people couldn't help but hear like our laughter and our comments and wanted to watch, and we had a little bit of a crowd around us, and I was like, see, this is what I think Commander should be. We're all goofy, we're not really sure what we're doing, we're not sure how this is going to go, but we're having a good time, and I feel like we, you know, maybe it's just me, but I feel like maybe we wouldn't have attracted that crowd if we were game face and serious and raw, but because we were just goofs, people wanted to be a part of that, and I love that.
Yeah, at its best, Commander is not about grinding wins. It's about creating stories with people you like.
Yeah.
And you can just create the most epic moments imaginable. And when I talk to people who play Commander all the time, they love it for its shenanigans, for its unique moments. You can sit down just at these impossible board states, and you're really not sure what's going to happen, and anyone can win at that point, because the plays are usually just so sweeping. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking forward to talking to you more about that.
Okay. All right. Let's get to it. So speaking of creating stories, I want to talk about you, AE. For starters, what does AE stand for?
Now, people ask me this question a lot. And in some respects, it is an odd question because, I mean, I must have abbreviated my name for a reason. And I can't help but wonder if some people secretly hope my name is highly embarrassing. Now, I'm sure that's not the case with you, Aaron, but also, maybe they want to know my name in order to magically compel me. As all wizards know, you have to know someone's true name before you can command them. So answer me truthfully, Aaron. Are you a wizard?
No, I am not.
All right, so you say. I'll trust you this time. Well, my name is Alcatraz Eventide Marling, named after the place and time of my conception. I hope you're satisfied, Aaron.
Oh, my goodness. Is that seriously your name?
Well, I mean, seriously, are you implying that I could tell a lie? You know, Aaron, I am offended that you would say that I, a fantasy fiction writer, would tell a truth.
Well, this is my show, so it's all about confessions and you know, sometimes dirty secrets. And, you know, if you were to come out, if you wanted to end the facade, you know, here might be the show to do it. So if you want to, that's fine. If not, you know, RK Post, he didn't tell me his real name either, but he gave me a hint. And he said, my name rhymes with a body part. And that sent my listeners wild. We were coming up with spleen and nose and, you know, everything. And you know, even some silly ones like, you know, kidney, penis, you know. We had a good time with that. And, you know, he gave us a little something to chew on, you know.
Well, I'll tell you this much. My friends do call me Alan, and my minions call me Master. So you can take your pick.
Oh, my. I think I heard that on a date once. It's interesting, because when I was looking you up, there is also an individual named A.E. Marling, and his is Alfred Erskine Marling.
Oh, that is beautiful.
Yeah, and I was like, that's very distinguished. So either way, I think it's good. I'll take it any way I can get it. So where did you grow up, A.E.?
So I live near San Francisco, okay. Between the Pacific Ocean's Great White Sharks and Yosemite National Park's Great White Cliffs. Also, more importantly, perhaps, near just a hub of competitive magic. Channel Fireball has its store nearby in Santa Clara. Grand Prix San Jose is coming up in the end of January. I'll be happy to compete there. Grand Prix, I find to be just the right amount of competition for me. I make day two about half the time, and I really enjoy playing against the pros occasionally. Also, the climate around here is Mediterranean, so I get to run over the Golden Hills.
So have you been to the Channel Fireball store?
Yes. It's a... So, well, once I accidentally went to their warehouse, because I messed up the address, and people were like, well, what are you doing here? Like, isn't F&M here? And no, it's just huge, just a vault abyss of cards. It is intense. So they tackled me, you know, and tased me and then dragged me out of there. That's what happened. And I eventually found the store.
Mm-hmm. Now,
the actual game center.
Now, do you get the feeling when you go to the game center that you are at somewhere special? Like, do you get that feeling, or is it just another game store?
No, it is intense. Not only just because a lot of very strong players play there, but they have these banners stretching back for like 30 or 40 pre-releases hanging along their walls. They have, they don't have too many actual cards on display there because there's no room, but you have that the warehouse. But no, it is intense. It's a great place to go. I also like playing in Eudaimonia, which is another competitive store in Berkeley, and then Galaxy Games was closest to where I live.
It sounds like you could really see the history of the Channel Fireball store. Like, you know, you said all those banners and everything like that. I love that. I love seeing, you know, where a store has been based on the expansions and things like that. So what were your early years like? Like, were you this creative as a child?
Well, I can't remember much from my early years before 18, but one thing that does come to mind was that it turns out I had trouble learning to read. My parents would give me a book like See Spot Run, and I could see that was worth useless. I didn't care where Spot ran. But then they gave me a computer game, an RPG called Ultima Underworld 2, The Labyrinth of Worlds. And that game involved a lot of dialogue, a lot of speaking, and you had to know how to read to understand what they were saying to you, and how to reply so the golems wouldn't smash in the pulp. Now, I had to learn to read then in order to save the kingdom. So that worked out. Now, it might sound strange learning to read from a computer game, but remember, this was before magic cards were printed, so I had to use the next best thing.
My mom likes to tell stories of how I learned to read from watching Wheel of Fortune. And I used to sit on her lap and we would, you know, we would watch them pick letters and then, you know, they would unveil the letters and I would guess the words. And I was really good at it. And then I would read the final puzzle and that's how I learned to read. We also used to watch Jeopardy together. And yeah, we used to watch kids' game shows and that's how I became really good at it. And I was reading at a higher reading level throughout my childhood. Like I was in third grade reading at a fifth grade level and I used to just consume books, summer reading clubs and all of that. And I kind of miss that. I feel like I definitely don't read as much as I used to. And I feel like I should work on that.
Once I was able to learn to read, of course, it unlocks all these wonderful treasure troves of adventures in the library. I love the Hobbit by Tolkien. These early books were very formative, and R.A. Salvatore's Homeland, which is about a subterranean city full of murder and enchanted fairy purple twilight light. So it was just perfect, in other words. Also, I love the Enchanted Forest Chronicles by Patricia C. Reed. And that story is about very practical princesses managing their dragons. So it was just great informative stuff.
Yeah, I have to admit, I didn't really read a lot of fantasy growing up. You know, I did plow through the Goosebumps series. I was a big R.L. Stein fan. I did move on to the Fear Street series as I got older. So I read a lot of what you call tawdry books, I guess. Nothing with, like, great, you know, literary value or anything. I did read a lot of the Star Trek novels because I was a big nerd growing up, and I enjoyed those. And Dean Koontz. I was a huge fan of Dean Koontz back in the day. So I would read about these terrible, you know, gory situations that would frighten my classmates. And, yeah, I used to just read really out there things. Nothing beautiful, you know, as you described.
Well, what I love about I collect reasons why people enjoy the fantasy genre. And first and foremost, it's imagination, also escape, and escaping into infinite possibility. In many ways, it recaptures the joy we experienced as children when we were playing the game of make-believe, and it allows us to indulge in that in adults. Just the ability to form in your mind that anything could be true is a very powerful creative tool. And I can quote Terry Pratchett when he says, "You need to believe in things that aren't true. How else can they become?" Mm-hmm. And I believe that just keeping yourself open to anything is a large part of the creative process and very valuable to us as humans. Just it's our greatest strength. Mm-hmm. Now, I like fantasy a little bit is what I'm saying.
I could tell that. Now, how did you discover magic?
Let's see. How did I discover? Oh, okay. So when I was in elementary school, my friend gave me a revised 4th edition Island Fish Gisconius. And this was just an amazing thing for, you know, an 11-year-old kid or however old I was. Now, of course, he immediately regretted giving it to me because it's a 6/8 creature for 7 mana. And it has Island Home, and you only had to spend 3 blue to untap it. So clearly, it's just a powerhouse, just the most amazing card ever. And we argued because I didn't want to give it back. And today, we never speak. But don't worry, I kept the Island Fish, so it's happy ending.
So you actually stopped being friends with somebody over Island Fish Gisconius?
Well, we did make up for it at the moment, but it could be that resentment just carried through, and that's why we don't talk today.
I remember this card, and I actually just looked it up while you were talking just to refresh my memory. It's the big fish that's literally an island.
Oh, yes, yes.
Oh, I have memories, yeah.
I think I have a particular soft spot for sea monsters. And when I opened my first Fallen Empires pack, I was overjoyed to have opened a deep spawn. I had it made. Deep spawn is a huge giant, two giant crustacean of some sort coming right at you.
Yes.
And for the time, the artwork was quite good and very powerful. And again, it's that ability for fantasy and also magic cards to convey you to another place. It really just opens your minds to what could be. That is so exciting.
Mm-hmm. You must be a big fan of the card Whelming Wave from Theros Block.
Oh, yes. They printed it just for me. That was so kind of them.
You would like the opponent I played at game day. One of the people I played at game day had this bizarre blue-white control deck, and it wasn't – we'll get there. So you think it's a blue-white control deck, so he's playing the temples, and you're like, okay, you know, I'm going to expect some dissolves and maybe some end hostilities and things like that. He gets to the point where he starts playing this – I can't think of the name of it, but it's a Scourge of Fleets, where when you play it, you bounce creatures.
It was like one of the promo cards, and yeah, it's returning all creatures with power equal to the less number of islands you have in play, I believe.
Yeah, so he has four Whelming Wave, four of those, Clever Impersonator to then copy that card. And I was playing Constellation at the time, which is all about having a very large board state. And I can't tell you how many times he would do that. I would suddenly have a hand of 14 cards, and then I'd be like, well, I don't have the mana to cast all of these, and I had to discard down to 7. It was super annoying.
Oh, I'm sorry, Aaron. I'm not on your side on this story. I can just see myself cackling just in glee, just seeing the waves crash over your silly dryads and just sweeping all your star constellations away, as he should.
And it just happened over and over again. I was just like, oh, come on. And I did ultimately end up beating him, but it was just so frustrating because it just kept happening and happening. And yeah, I have a feeling you'd like that. Now, you wrote your first fantasy novella in high school. Tell me about some of the work that led up to that.
All right. Well, perhaps I should say earlier in my the same elementary school, I was lucky enough to have a creative writing class. And this was something that was encouraged. And I believe my first stories involved Bowser, the nemesis of Super Mario, with Godzilla, both wearing Hawaiian shirts with purple sunglasses. So as you can see, my writing has always been in the best of taste. Now, during that same time, or no, a little bit earlier than that, after my parents had told me a bedtime story and the lights went out, I couldn't get to sleep. So I told myself another an hour or so of what turned out to be epic fantasy stories. I'd make up worlds and adventures for myself, and eventually I would then pass out. And as you might imagine, that habit blossomed as I was an adult into a robust insomnia. So let's see. And you mentioned my novella that I wrote in high school. So I grew up in California, and during the summer, it's just the sky is blue and the sun's beaming down on you. Everyone in the streets is laughing, and of course, Of course, I had to get away from all that, and so I shut myself in this tiny room with a Macintosh computer with a word processor, and the screen was about the size of a polished tablespoon, and that's when I wrote my novella. And incidentally, some of the characters that I had first imagined in those early bedtime stories I told myself were in this novella. Of course, they'd grown along with me, become a little more complex and nuanced. Let's see. What did I do with that novella? I learned from it.
Okay, so did you – I guess what I'm asking is, like, you know, how did you release it? Like, did you keep it to yourself? Did you show it to all your friends? Was it like a homework assignment? Like, who got to see that work?
My friends and family.
Yeah.
It was I did not promote it very much.
Do you still, like, remember it? Or, you know, are you proud of that moment? Like, look back on it and go, that was a good book. Or do you look back on it and go, ooh, I was terrible?
I haven't read it for some years. Okay. It was probably fine.
Okay. I actually used to do some writing as well, but mine sort of fell into the, you know, the Fear Street camp, where I remember one of the first stories I ever wrote was about, and it's kind of interesting that this became a movie. I wrote a story about people in mirrors who, like, you know, there's like a mirror universe, and, you know, there was a girl that had an antique mirror, and somebody came through the mirror and wanted to, like, invade us with their mirror people. Like, I had all these really crazy stories. And you know,
I like that, because whenever Because it takes away people's sense of safety when they're at home. Looking in the mirror, and there always could be someone sneaking up behind them. So I like that story.
Yeah, I remember I wrote a story called The Homecoming Court, which is like a slasher story about, you know, somebody tries to kill the members of the homecoming court and all this stuff. And I was very influenced by things like that. Maybe I just watched too much Unsolved Mysteries as a kid. I don't know. But
I think many high school students have that fantasy, to be honest.
But I mean, it was tasteful. Like, I wasn't like I was into gratuitous gore where it's like, you know, someone's brain stem was on the stairs. No, it was,
surely,
you know,
not
just,
Aaron. I would never accuse him of that. No.
But, you know, it was meant to be sort of scary and edgy. And I always thought that was really interesting. So.
Mm-hmm.
So now, for those who may not be familiar, tell me a little bit about your books. Like, what are they about? Some of your noteworthy characters, like, fill us in.
All right. Well, my stories plunge readers into the deep end of fantasy. Readers who love my stories typically are fantasy veterans who are tired of the tropes. I found when I was reading many fantasy story after fantasy story, I found that there were more chosen one orphans than you could shake a magic sword at. And the theme seemed to be frequently that anyone, no matter how average and unprepared, could save the day. And I mean, that's sometimes true. In Magic Card tournaments, we know that anyone with even the worst, most unfavorable matchup can win. But usually it's the person who's done their preparation, has tested, reached a calm state, is really the most professionally polished. And so all these, every man's becoming heroes weren't something I was entirely comfortable with. Well, as I was reading, I discovered that I became more and more frustrated with the heroes and started rooting for the villains. And mainly because the villains were usually, they were just great, colorful characters, highly passionate about something, and they prepared, schemed, some call it scheming, for a long time in order to make their move. Mm-hmm. And they were very proactive. So in my own writing, the protagonists do have a little bit of a villain about them, and maybe a little bit more than that, because I want them to be very dynamic, have a lot of flaws and serious flaws. Sometimes they're bitter, sometimes they're grumpy, but they're very passionate about pursuing their magical abilities. They're very relentless in their pursuit of defeating the greater villain and saving their friends. Let's see. I also subscribe to the Brandon Sanderson School of Magical Thought, and that is, if the protagonist has a magic, which mine all do, mm-hmm. the rules of this magic need to be established so they can build on this and innovate in a way which feels earned and reasonable, and it doesn't feel like they're cheating in order to get it. And in other words, they don't say, oh, I wish the Dark Lord to be dead, and poof, he's gone. That would be an unsatisfying ending. But by establishing clear rules for your magic, you can avoid that. And I will say that games like Magic Cards have made me keenly aware of balance, and that each magic system should have its own flair and nuance. And again, the balance or some cost for your spells in order to make them feel deserved.
Now, I have to ask you, as a writer, A.E., what do you think of Wizards' way of storytelling and way of communicating what these sets are about? Like, do you like that? Do you think they can maybe do a little better at that? Like, what do you think as a writer?
Actually, one of the Shards of Alara block particularly impressed me, because they had 5 different realms. One of them was Esper, and it's just, they really got a just combined storytelling with mechanics, with visual arts, and just a huge amount of creativity, which is very impressive. So I am very much in love with the backstory of Magic Cards and how it integrates into the gameplay. And for that reason, I'm really excited about this upcoming Commander set. But again, we'll talk more about that later.
Sure, sure. You know, how did you feel about them killing off Elsbeth? Were you a fan of that?
Well, I mean, sometimes you have to do that in the final act, but I feel like she's not really dead. She's a planeswalker. She'll come back. She'll be resurrected in some capacity. So that's what I assume is going on, and it will happen eventually.
Okay, okay. One thing I've also discovered about you, A.E., is you receive a lot of positive feedback for your portrayal of women. I saw a couple of blog posts about that, and this was mentioned a lot in the reviews about how you do a really good job of portraying women. And, you know, in fantasy, that can be a weak spot, admittedly. We have seen a little bit lacking in magic, but it's gotten much better. I know in a game like World of Warcraft, it's not good. what is it that you think you do differently that gives these women their due, as opposed to what others might not do, or how can we fix that?
Well, perhaps it's because most of my books are from the perspective of women, mm-hmm. and when I do character creation, I get into their history, what they've been through. I'm very much interested in the culture where they've been raised, even if it's a fantasy culture, giving them the background, which is going to make them a fully fleshed out character. Also, my beta readers, my reading vanguards, includes women, and they let me know whenever I misstep. And they might cackle while doing so. I don't hold that against them.
Now, why choose to portray the stories through the eyes of women? Because you would think as an author, you'd want to be, you know, you'd want to start with something you're familiar with. And I don't believe that you are female. So what about that, you know, made you go there?
It takes overwhelming hubris to begin a story and overwhelming humility to edit it. But when I'm sitting in a library, just surrounded by countless books and stories, I'm looking for something which has been told as much before. And the simple fact is, most stories are not told from the perspective of women, especially movies. If you look at movies, they're almost exclusively led by men, and the majority of characters are men in those movies. Even the support characters are mainly men, and there's usually like one token female, and that's just not how I wanted to tell my stories. Usually about half the characters are women, or more than half, and that's what I aim for. I feel we do need that variety at this point.
I agree. What is it about writing that you enjoy so much, A.E., and what keeps you going?
Let's see. It's really like 100,000 words of crossword puzzle when I'm designing these stories. And I do love outlining and planning them ahead of time. And unlike a Magic card tournament, I can edit out my mistakes in the second draft.
I admit that was one of my shortcomings as a writer is, you know, I would always hear these people say, just get it out. Just get it on paper, get it on the screen, and edit it later. And I was always the type of person where I would get three sentences in and be like, oh, I could have worded that differently. Delete, 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 delete. Or, you know, oh, that word, I don't like that word. Delete, delete, delete. And I would get so hung up and I would two steps forward, one step back. And I really think that was one of my problems and why I feel like I have a lot of good stories in my head. I just have to, you know, buckle down and get them out. And then don't stop until they're out because I get distracted by making them perfect.
Well, everyone is different in terms of writing, but there are two main perspectives. One is that you're just going to have to begin a story and let it flow, and you'll eventually figure out what it's about, what the plot's about. And then there's the other perspective, which is the one I use, where you begin with an outline. You make sure you have a cohesive story. You build it up girder by girder, and you start with this outline, this story structure, and on that skeleton, you build a wonder, and that's where you add your creativity. You make sure ahead of time all the twists and turns are going to be there in your story. So as I said, there are two ways to write stories, and it just so happens that outline one, which I use, is the correct one, and the other one's totally wrong. That's just how it ends up.
So almost...
And I feel that maybe if you begin with this outline, if you understand the structure of a story, you can kind of build things and be confident and be more sure of where you're going.
It almost sounds like you're talking about cooking, where like you advocate having like a recipe in front of you and not just, you know, throwing stuff in a pot and then trying to make a meal.
Well, I believe that the craft of storytelling has advanced over the years. We now have a better understanding of where the narrative beats of a story should go, how readers should feel at certain parts of the story. Like in the midpoint of the story, you do not want everything to collapse and for your hero to be in a state of despair. It will feel like your hero is getting nowhere. You'll just get frustrated with the story. And I've read a few manuscripts like that. Whereas if the moment of despair happens close to the end, then the protagonist has achieved some small victories, and you're like, oh, they've succeeded in the past. I know they can pull through. I'm going to stick it out with them. And then when they do succeed, you have this huge uplifting, this feeling of numinous, it's called, if I'm remembering that correctly. They're returning to the fray, and they have regained their sense of confidence, purpose, drive, and everything is falling into place. They've used what they've learned throughout the story, and then they're able to defeat the villain who has not changed. And all these story structure elements are coming together, and once you understand them, you can implement them in your story, make them your own, make them additionally creative. And once you do that, then the reader is more likely to respond in the ways you want. So I firmly believe that understanding of the tale, the narrative arc, has increased, and it would be silly of me not to learn of that and try to make my stories as close to that as possible.
One of the terms that kept coming up in my research of you was the phrase independent storyteller. And I believe on your own bio, on your website, you describe yourself as being an independent storyteller. What does that mean?
Well, that means I publish my books independently. I'm responsible for every stage in development of hiring people, hiring editors, and then I sell them on online stores like Amazon specifically. That gives me a complete creative control, and I do admit I love overwhelming power. For instance, I have one story. I wanted some maps, so I hired a cartographer from England, and I then hired him to do some internal illustrations for that book. And for the cover, I have hired an illustrator from Russia, and then another pair of illustrators from Slovenia.
Wow.
And my editors, I'm not sure where they live, but I assume Hades. And in fact, speaking of the Netherworlds, I hired a voice actor from Los Angeles. And then for the graphic design, I hired my high school buddy because, quite frankly, he crushes at graphic design.
Now, if you don't mind me asking, the decision to go, you know, on your own and be self-published, was this something that you had a say in, or was this a matter of, you know, maybe you didn't have a lot of luck with the big publishers, so you were like, okay, that's fine, I'll just do it by myself. Like, you know, who decided this?
It was an exciting opportunity, which, I mean, you didn't used to be able to self-publish, but I just finished a story, and it wasn't hitting the right button, so to speak, and that in part because it was a little niche, but I was able to, as I said, go through that process and publish it online as Buddha Bones. And that story, the protagonist is, as I said, very, maybe I didn't mention this, but she has flaws, but not only flaws, she has an invisible illness, a disease called hypersomnia, which causes her to sleep more than she lives. And because of that, she's really in a point close to madness, because not only does she have this disease, but no one believes she actually is sick. They just believe she's lazy. Mm-hmm. And that's caused her to become very at the brink of things, mm-hmm. emotionally, or close to madness.
Do you think there's ever a time where you would consider signing with a publisher, or are you very happy with what you've got right now?
Well, I am editing two manuscripts currently. One is for middle grade readers, and one is for young adult readers. And I'm really leap over cliffs excited about these stories. And these I will be pitching to editors and agents and to try to publish them through conventional means. And the reason for that is because traditional publishers are best at distributing books in order to physical bookstores, and that's where youths buy the most of their literature.
Mm-hmm. Are you a little worried about, you know, signing with a bigger publisher and maybe losing some of that power and some of that freedom that you described?
Well, that will be tough, I will admit.
Okay. And do you recommend self-publishing to other writers, or do you recommend going the traditional route of you get your agent, you get your book deal, and you do all that?
Well, just a moment. I said that would be tough about signing over some of my control, but granted, they do have people there who have a lot of expertise, and it will be fun to work with some editors who have a great understanding of the business. Now that I've gotten that brown nosing done, you wanted to know if I recommend self-publishing to other authors. Let's see. So I would hesitate to self-publish a first novel. Personally, I wrote four practice novels before I finally published this fifth one, which turned out to be Brute of Bones. And ultimately, let's see, after you finished your first novel, you're just full of excitement and enthusiasm. I would channel this into submitting your pitch idea to agents, and it's possible we'll catch on there. Also, to go to conferences, to network, talk with other writers, learn your craft, read books on writing. After you've done that for a while, in fact, have written three novels, I would say then go back to your first, re-edit it, because it will need editing, and see how you feel about your first novel at that point. And if you still think it's just amazing and you really want people to know about it, but for some crazy, ridiculous reason, it hasn't been picked up by one of the big four publishers, then that'd be a good time to consider self-publishing it. Now, it could be that your goals are different, that what you really just want is you finish this book, it's your first book, and you just want it to be in a nice physical book form, something that you can give to your friends and family during, for Christmas gifts or something like that. Self-publishing is good for that too. You can have one of your friends illustrate it for on the cheap, have maybe a friend look over for editing it, self-edit it, read it aloud to yourself, self-edit it like that, and then you can publish it through CreateSpace relatively inexpensively. So that's a reasonable option as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, where do you see yourself in the next few years, AE? Like, what are some goals that you'd like to achieve?
Well, I would always like to be a better writer. I'm just pursuing new ways to learn and perfect my craft. Perfect is the wrong word because there's always more to learn, and that's part of what's so exciting about it. For instance, and next year I have another story that I've outlined. I will be begin writing that soon. I'm cackling excited about that. It's just going to be very fun. And let's see. Well, beyond that, the fog of war makes things too far in the future uncertain. But one thing I am definite about is I will continue to be playing Magic cards.
Okay. Now, you brought up the fact that you like to cackle. Like, when I asked you to come on the show, you had mentioned cackling. You mentioned the cackle now. Can I hear the cackle?
That's rather personal. I feel that, I mean, if there ever comes a time when, a bolt of lightning strikes outside your house and I'm standing out there with two electrical smart cords crackling together, that would be a time when you would hear my cackle, but now is not really the time.
Oh, wow. So cackling is sort of like your version of singing. Like, some people sing in the car, they sing in their bedroom, but they would never sing in public. Is that true, like, for you with cackling?
Well, let's see. Yes. For instance, when playing a game of Commander and I had a bunch of indestructible slivers in play, because at heart I am evil, once I had a bunch of indestructible slivers in play, then I cast Jokalops, which destroys all destroys all permanents, basically. That was a good time to cackle, I feel. But, there's a time and a place for it, and I don't want to just feel like I'm being used for my cackle. I think that would be wrong, Aaron. I think what you're asking is wrong.
All right. Well, I will have to have you back on the show someday, and that'll be my big, expose. It's like, some people come on the show to discuss their alcoholism or to maybe discuss their marriages falling apart. You will come on and your confessional will be, he's finally ready to reveal his cackle. Like, that's going to be...
It's really not a problem, though. It's more of a solution.
Well, speaking of solutions and problems, I did sort of contact you very spur of the moment because something fell into my lap that I absolutely could not say no to. And it's part of the reason why I invited you on the show. We've talked about it, here and there about, Commander and Magic and things like that. I have been given a Commander 2014 preview card.
Yes.
And you are going to help me
unveil it. Dancing with Dryads, excited to talk about this.
This is a big deal. I've never had one of these before, and I was a little concerned about, how are we going to, you can't see it, so how is it going to convey through a podcast? But I think you and I could pull it off, yeah?
All right, yeah. All right, Would you like to read it?
Yes, I'm going to go ahead and unveil this. Now, this is a character that I remember from my early, early days of playing Magic. Her name is Titania, Protector of Argoth. That name immediately struck a chord in my mind. She costs 3 colorless and 2 green.
So 5 total. Mm-hmm.
Legendary creature, elemental. And her text says, when Titania, Protector of Argoth, enters the battlefield, return target land card from your graveyard to the battlefield. Which to me sounds hot. I'm in already.
It's not only a card advantage, it's a 2-for-1, but also it's accelerating you, which is what green is known for and what you want to be doing in.
Oh, but Commander. We're not even done. We're not even there yet.
No, we aren't.
And then it also says, whenever a land you control is put into a graveyard from the battlefield, put a 5/3 green elemental creature token onto the battlefield. And Titania herself is also 5/3, so her power is
so high. Let me break this down on a flavor aspect.
Hit me, AE.
Okay, you're in a clearing of the Argoth Forest, which has been devastated. It's been clear-cut. And from a stump, Titania rises, and she's a 5/3 creature, just a hugely powerful being. And then she regrows the forest around her. Trees spit up from the land, grow to full height. Everything is back into full bloom. And if someone else is foolish enough to try to destroy another part of the Argoth Forest, she will recreate a reflection of herself, another 5/3, to come in and kick that lumberjack's ass. You've heard of Smokey the Bear. He prevents forest fires. He's only a 2/2. She's a juggernaut. She's a 5/3. Yes.
And this is all very appropriate for her. Like, for those who don't know, she's been in the lore of Magic for a long time. She was one of the original Morrow Sorcerers, which has been a term that's been tossed around. I looked up her salvation entry. She was around for the Brothers War. I mean, she's been in the lore for quite some time.
And we really get a twofer for the reference of her, because not only Titania, she's existed on some cards, but we also get a place, the Argoth, for us. And that's crucial to a lot of the most some iconic cards in Commander and Magic history. For instance, Argothian Enchantress, a classic Enchantress. Also, Argoth is mentioned in the flavor text of Exploration and Vernal Bloom. Vernal Bloom doubles your mana. And also, Gia's Cradle, one of the most coveted lands in the Commander format, is located in Argoth.
Yeah.
Now imagine this. Someone destroys your Gia's Cradle, as they must in Commander, because it's just incredibly powerful. You tap it, it adds one green for every creature you control, but you have to destroy that. And they destroy it, and then you cast Titania, you bring it back into play. That flavor win is so intense that everyone around you, your opponents will just die or orgasm or both. It's just going to be that intense. And this card is just very exciting because we've never seen an effect like this on a Commander before. It's going to open up a whole new avenue of deck building. It's just what we want. It's just such a win. Also, the mana cost is perfect. 5-3 for 5. That's exactly what we'd expect to pay for a 2-for-1 creature. Acidic Slime is a staple in Commander, and this is even better than that. Also, it protects you from Armageddon effects.
Oh, yeah.
If the opponent is playing a Commander like Zurgo, Helm Smasher, Kalia the Vast, perhaps Sliver Hive Lord, and their plan is just to blow up everything, that's going to give you a huge swath of Juggernaut 5-3 elemental creatures. Mm-hmm. Also, it just synergizes very well with the fetch lands, strip mine, and then if someone destroys your Maze of Ith, you can bring it back into play. For instance, I play Xenagod, and that deck just folds to Maze of Ith. I have a ton of cards in there which destroy it, and if they bring Maze of Ith back into play, the party's over. It's just done.
Yeah. Now, we were talking earlier about, you know, competitive Commander and sort of fun Commander. Do you see Titania being in more of the spiky decks, or do you see her being in more of the wee kind of decks?
Well, it depends. You could go deep into the woods of flavor in terms of saying this is a Vorthos or a Johnny card. But flavor itself has value in Commander. It's not like other just one-on-one formats where you can play a fun deck and you don't get any bonus points for that. But in Commander, if you're playing a flavorful deck with cool, interesting cards people haven't seen before, they're less likely to attack you. You're likely to win more games. So flavor has some real utility in Commander, especially if the cards in your deck, which appear weak, are in fact strong because they synergize with your Commander in unexpected ways. Mm-hmm. Now, it is also can be a spike card in the sense that you can play this without some of the more combo-y aspects we're going to get into later, just as an accelerant and something to recycle your fetch lands and then continue to use fetch lands. And whenever you pop a fetch land, you get another 5-3. And that will work even in a monocolor deck. You can play Wooded Foothills and such. And of course, you're recycling your wastelands. But it also can be very much a Timmy card, I would say, because you can use cards like Chain of Acid, and you can, using that, you can just destroy all your lands at once, or you can use Claws of Gix and just sacrifice all your lands at end of turn, and then you have an army of 5-3 lumberjack-hating juggernauts, and you can use that to take out that pesky blue player.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had mentioned a couple cards that this might go really well with. You know, are there any other combos you can think of, or any other cards that this would be amazing with? I was thinking Crucible of Worlds, but that's just me.
Oh, yes. Well, that is one of them. But I'm going to go pretty deep here. So you might have to rein me back occasionally, Aaron. But the first thing that comes to mind is, of course, mass land destruction. Mm-hmm. And the second thing that comes to mind is that green doesn't have any of that.
Yeah.
And that's perhaps for the best. It will be a little bit difficult to pull off. But say Titania is not your commander. She's just one of the 99. For instance, you draw Armageddon and you are playing with Captain Sisse as your commander. Then you can search up Titania, play her, and then play Armageddon, and then you've won. Now, I will say, there is a 101 on how not to be a dick in Commander in terms of Armageddon effects. If you cast an Armageddon and you don't immediately win, then you're just being a terrible person because you're dragging out the game and you're frustrating everyone. However, if you cast an Armageddon effect, some sort of mass destruction effect, which immediately leads you to winning the game, then, you know, it's just good game and people can pick up their cards and go on to the next one. Now, I will say that you don't want to do this all the time. I believe in the 75% philosophy championed by Jason Ault on GatheringMagic.com, where he says you don't really want to be tutoring up Titania and casting Armageddon or Catastrophe or something like that every game. It's going to get very tiresome. People aren't going to play with you. You might win more, but are you really winning? Because this is you're not even getting any Planeswalker points for this. Mm-hmm. I would argue that you want to shy away from tutor effects in Commander. Because, you know, that sort of thing, it's going to give consistency to your competitive constructive decks, but that shouldn't really be the point of a casual deck. So I would shy away from those sorts of strategies. And for the rest of my strategies, I'll be talking about as if she's your commander in a mono-green deck, which does not have access to huge board sweepers like Armageddon. The first ones which come to mind are, what lands do you want to play with Titania? One which has been spoiled is called Myriad Landscape. It's a new double fetch lands, which most every commander deck will want to play. It's just great design. When you sacrifice that, and she can get that back after you sacrifice it, or when you sacrifice it and she's in play, you get a bonus 5/3. Combine that with the new rare fetch lands like Windswept Heath, and then the common fetches like Evolving Wilds, and also Mountain Valley from the old Mirage cycle. And also, oh, this is so exciting. You can play and justify playing some of my favorite lands, which are otherwise just too ridiculous to justify. And those are Lotus Vale and Scorched Ruins. And when you put these lands into play, you have to sacrifice two other lands, and then you create a huge target for yourself. Everyone with an acidic slime is going to destroy your Lotus Vale, which is essentially a triple land, because it taps for 3 mana of any color. But when you have Titania in play, she'll discourage people from doing that, and if they do, then you have another 5/3, and you probably got 2 5/3s just from sacrificing the lands in the first place. Mm-hmm. Also, you can play the niche double lands like Havenwood Battleground. It's from Fallen Empires.
Yes. I remember that.
Oh, yes. And you can sacrifice to add 2 green. Similarly, you can play with City of Traitors, Crystal Vein, Hickory Woodlot, and also the cycle lands, even like Slippery Karst. You cycle that away turn 2. She'll get it back on turn 4 or 5 whenever you cast her and accelerate you with it. And then there's the hard hitters, Wasteland, Strip Mine, Dust Bowl.
That was the first thing that came to my mind.
Yeah, this is the spiky aspect of her. You have to decide how many you want to play, but in the same, Horizon Canopy is going to feel more flavor-centric to her.
Now, how do you think she's going to go with card? They just released Freyalise today, Freyalise Yanowar's Fury. Did you happen to see that?
Freyalise is going to be the one of the headliner generals for the mono green deck. Mm-hmm. How would she work with that? Well, I mean, she doesn't have synergies, but they'll be fine together.
Well, and, I was thinking, you know, you do make these creatures, you know, so like let's say you get Elemental Happy and you make a couple Elementals, you can use Freyalise's +2 to put a 1/1 green elf druid creature token, and then I misread that wrong. I'm sorry. Oh yeah, her ultimate though, draw a card for each green creature you control. You know, that could be kind of fun. Suddenly you have this board full of elementals and you draw a bunch of cards. That can be cool.
There's certainly no downside there.
Yeah.
So I have a few more lands I could talk about. And
please
then we'll,
do.
We'll go on to the spells. So there's some utility lands like Glacial Chasm, which prevents you from dying. You can reuse that. And then Haunted Fengraph, which returns a creature from your graveyard to your hand, I believe. You can combine it with a few man lands if you want, like Treetop Village and Gargoyle Castle. And even maybe the old Zoetic Cavern, which is a morph land creature. You play it, it's a land, but it has morph. So if someone kills it as a 2/2 or tries to kill it, you can morph it, and then it becomes a land, and they waste their removal spell. More likely, though, it will just be a 2/2 for 3, and when it dies in combat, then she can bring it back into play. There are spell combos with this card. Number one, I would say, is Scapeshift. That's going to allow you to sacrifice all your lands.
I didn't even think of that.
Oh yes, and put as many 5/3s in play as you can as you have land. So that's going to be quite good. A little more. That's the best one.
Can I interrupt
Next
you for a
is,
second? Does yes? Escape Shift C play in EDH?
Well, now it will now.
Okay, because I know Titania. I'm a modern girl, so when I see Scape Shift, I know the game is pretty much over. And I was wondering if it had that same sort of impact or
okay.
feel in EDH.
Well, in modern, it's killing you instantly because you have Valakut the Molten Pinnacle. and play. And I mean, you're not playing, you're probably not playing those two cards in the same deck with Titania. But in Titania, it's just going to recycle all your lands and put a swath of 5/3 juggernauts in play. Another on the list is Natural Balance. So that Scape Shift was the best one. These are progressing into more and more Timmy at this point. Natural Balance is an old card, which I used to play in my Prosperous Bloom combo deck. And it says, everyone who has more than 5 lands sacrifices down to 5 lands. And what that will do is it will equalize the board a little bit, and while giving you quite a few 5/3 creatures. Now, the problem with this is, since you're green, you'll probably have more lands than anyone else. And so it's going to hurt you more than anyone else. Another one is Gia's Balance. And this is probably one you've never seen before in EDH. And that's the exciting part about this card. We're going to cards good with Titania might never have been seen before in EDH, and people will want to play you to see these cards, and they won't attack you first. So people will enjoy seeing this deck. Gia's Balance, it says, when you play it, sacrifice 5 lands, which is just what you want to do, then search your library for a land of each type. So you can get a forest and then a stomping grounds and one of each of the other shocks and put them into play. And then you have 5/5/3s. Five/5/3s as well with Titania. Another one, Overlaid Terrain. It's an enchantment. When it comes to play, you sacrifice all your lands. And then from then on, all your lands produce double mana. And you have a swath of 5/3s. Mm-hmm. Now, in order for these 5/3s to be good, they might well get wrathed away. But if you have a haste effect, the ability to attack, there aren't too many haste effects with green, but I would play both of them that I know are available. Concordant Crossroads and Achroma's Memorial. Both those will give your 5/3s haste, and you can hopefully take out that blue mage right then.
Achroma's Memorial, that's nasty.
Yeah. Concordant Crossroads is the more flavor-specific choice, but you probably want to play both. Now, other spells which help you sacrifice your lands for value. Crop Rotation is a very strong one. You can search up that Gia's Cradle if you're lucky to have one. Harrow. Renewal is pretty niche, but you could maybe play it. Edge of Autumn is delightful. It has this picture of a fairy surfing on a leaf. That's just the best. Also, this one is very strong. Constant Mists. You can fog every turn and buy it back for sacrificing a land. That's everything you want to be doing. And it's just very powerful. Borderline too powerful, but you're playing mono green probably. So other people can just suck it. You deserve these constant mists. Synergy, there's more spells which synergize with Titanium. And this one you really have to play. Mm-hmm. Realms Uncharted. It's a spinoff of Gifts Ungiven. You search your library for 4 lands, put 2 in your hand, 2 in the graveyard. It's an underplayed card, beautiful art, beautiful concept, and works very well with her. You can get all the lands you need to synergize with her. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Also, now this next one, I think, is part of the reason I would really be tempted to play her. You can add 2 cards which turn all lands into creatures. Living Plane and Nature's Revolt. Now, this is going to do something interesting to your commander game. Since all lands in play are creatures, the opponents cannot cast Wrath of God or any sort of creature board wipe effects, which are the mainstay of commander. If they do, then Titania will die and all your lands will die at the same time. Titania will see those lands enter the graveyard as she's dying. You'll get a whole bunch of 5/3s on an empty board, no lands, no creatures, and then you win. Mm-hmm. So it will prevent the opponent from casting Wrath of God, and that's really the green mage's dream. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Some more artifacts. You mentioned Crucible of Worlds. That is a good one to reuse the lands, the fetch lands you're putting in your graveyard. Also, Zurn Orb, at end of speed, instant speed, you can sacrifice all your lands at the opponent's end of turn and then swing in for the win if you see the moments right. Again, that's kind of the Timmy approach, higher risk. A more interesting one, or maybe more reasonable, is called Sandstone Deadfall. It is an artifact, and you can sacrifice it and 2 lands you control to destroy a target attacking creature. But the important part is you'll get the 2/5/3s, but also it's a deterrent, and that's stronger in Commander than just a source of plowshares. If you can deter someone from attacking you, that's the best place to be in. And then another mist fog effect called an artifact called Sunstone. It says you can sacrifice a snow-covered forest to fog for the turn. Mm-hmm. You could do that if you wanted, and then you'd also want to include Mouth of Ronin, mouth of Ronum, which synergizes with snow-covered lands. And let's see, there are some more creatures that help you reclaim the lands you're sacrificing from the graveyard, and this one is a must. And just it's such a such a beautiful card. It's called Cartographer. The artwork is fantastic. The other choices include Harvest Worm, Groundskeeper, Tilling Tree Folk, and there are some creatures which will put lands into your graveyard. One of them is Terastodon, which is a mainstay staple of Commander. You can destroy any non-land permanent, and you might want to destroy your own lands because that will give you 3/3 elephants and as well as your 5/3 elemental token. Another one is Nantuko Cultivator. You can discard lands. Squirrel Wrangler. Who wouldn't want to play with that? Squirrels. And he sacrifices your lands. Another neat one is Liege of the Tangle. He's an 8/8 for 8, and if he damages the opponent, you can turn any number of your lands into creatures.
I have that card in my own map deck, yeah.
So I would suggest turning all of them into creatures, because if the opponent then Wrath of Gods, you will get those back as 5/3s, and then you can kill them instantly. That seems a little bit more valuable. That is such a risky play to do normally, a little less risky in this instance. And then Silverglade Pathfinder is a spell shaper, and spell shapers have additional utility because you can discard lands. You do want to make sure you have that first land in your graveyard to utilize her ramp ability.
So it sounds like on the whole, this is a pretty good card.
It's pretty fair. I will say in the past Commander expansions, the Legends have been maybe a little bit too good. This one I feel is very fair. It's very sporting. It's not going to dominate the board state.
Okay. Well, I look forward to playing against this card. You've made Commander sound so much more, you know, more intriguing than I realized. And maybe it's not so bad after all, where I'm not going to consistently get stomped. And maybe I just need to find the right play group. And I want to play now. Like, this card is making me want to play.
I do have a few more thoughts on Titania.
Okay.
If we have time.
Well, I think we've sort of given people enough to chew on. I think we should let them pick up the set themselves and try it for themselves. Because I'm a big fan of, you know, learning by doing. So I think we should let people get their hands dirty. And let's move on to where people can find you. If they are interested in knowing more about you or getting a hold of you, AE, how can they do that? Where can they find you?
Well, I would suggest, since everyone here is familiar with Magic cards, I suggest reading the stories I've written on the subject. So the short story I have in Benny Smith's Complete Commander, you can find that on Star City Games. And on Gathering Magic, I have a short story actually about Liliana returning to the Abyss. It's called Paying Her Debts. And you can find these stories through Google. I will also tweet links to these stories on Twitter. I'm at A.E. Marling. I'll also post a blog post on my site, aemarling.com, with the links to these different stories.
And they can purchase your books through Amazon?
That is true.
Okay. Well, thank you, AE, so much for coming on the show and for walking me through Commander and explaining this wonderful new card to me, because I admit I didn't know very much about it. And I feel like I've gotten to know you a little bit better, and hopefully my listeners can feel the same.
Thank you so much for having me, Aaron. I wish you all the luck, and you never have to mulligan again.
I wish. I feel like I had to do so much of it at the Open this past weekend. And if anybody here is listening to the show and they've enjoyed what they've heard here on the Deck Tees, you can always find the show first and foremost on GatheringMagic.com. The show is available on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. You can subscribe and leave me a review and some stars. You can keep up with the show on Twitter at the Deck Tees. You can keep up with me on Twitter at Original Estrus. And you can also email the show at thedecktees@gmail.com. Thank you guys so much for listening. Enjoy the new Commander set, and take care of yourselves, okay? Bye!